history moves in zigs and zags. There are jumps and then there are retreats and so on. There is no, you know, progressive history or negative history. You know, everything gets better. I don't think that's very credible anymore. Nobody believes that. Everything gets worse. I don't think that's credible either. These are cliches. I think history has a very peculiar set of dynamics. Also, it's regionally bound. You know, something happens in the Arab world may not happen in Southeast Asia, etc.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on history and politics, zigs and zags, part two of a special two-part program. History and politics is replete with zigs and zags into all kinds of unexpected directions. Take, for example, the Shah of Iran. He looked impregnable on his throne until he was toppled by massive street demonstrations. Who could have predicted that the suicide of a street vendor in a small town in Tunisia would lead to the overthrow of an entrenched dictatorship and revolts across the Arab Middle East? Or that a popular uprising in Armenia would lead to the ouster of an oligarchic regime in that country? Or that a real estate mogul and reality TV host would become president of the United States? History and politics are full of surprises. Our guest today is historian and journalist Vijay Prashad. He's the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, based in Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, and India. He's also the editor of Leftward Books, based in New Delhi. Additionally, he's chief correspondent for Globetrotter and the author of many books, including The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and Red Star Over the Third World. I talked with Vijay Prashad in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Let's talk about a topic that might be dear to your heart, and that is liberal hypocrisy. They advocate the rule of law. They promote human rights. They extol the principle of self-determination. They call for freedom and justice everywhere except for Palestine.
Yes. And of course, now annexation of Palestine is on the table. It is very likely that Mr. Netanyahu is going to be the prime minister again. He has promised the beginning of this second election campaign that if elected, he is going to essentially seize all the settlement lands and bring them into Israel proper. If you look at a map of the Jordan Valley, what that means is a very small section, in the middle of an arc. On one side, you have the 1967 Israel lines, and then you have this rim that goes around on the high points of the Jordan Valley, and then the Palestinians are in a tiny enclave. East Jerusalem will be seized by Israel. Palestine is finished. The question all of this raises, it's not a question even for the Palestinians. It's not a question for you and me. It's nothing. It's a question for Israelis. You are creating an apartheid state. You will have to declare it an apartheid state because, you know, you have few options. One option is you absorb all the Palestinians and then you have to give them full citizenship. If you give the Palestinians full citizenship and if the Palestinians are allowed to vote freely, likelihood that they will have the largest, they'll have the biggest party in the Knesset, and then you'll have a Palestinian government. Now, you say, well, we want to be a Jewish state and a democracy. You cannot, because you cannot be both an ethnic state and a democracy. This is a problem Saudi Arabia faces, problem many other countries face. What am I saying? I'm saying that either you enfranchise all the Palestinians that you annex. If you don't enfranchise them, it's an apartheid state. So either you decide to be a democracy or an apartheid state. You can't be both. When you said liberal hypocrisy, it's liberal hypocrisy that starts from there. It's an amnesia about what is Israel. You know, is the United States a Christian nation? I mean, people who support the Zionist project in Israel should actually support the kind of evangelical project in the United States. Then the United States should fully claim to be a white Christian country and say that everybody else, you don't get the right to vote. You know, that's actually not hypocritical. You say, let's go all the way to authoritarianism, to kind of ethno-authoritarianism. If you're going to support that in Israel, I say support it in the United States. I say, let only white Christians vote. Everybody else should stop voting. We are disenfranchised. Let the, you know, right Christians take power. That's exactly what people here are saying should happen in Israel. It's horrendous. You know, the Palestinian movement itself has been so fragmented, so put under pressure all these decades, it's having a hard time challenging what's going on, having a hard time fighting against what's going on. In India, we see the emergence of Hindu far-right majoritarianism. Israel is already founded, in a sense, on far-right ethno-nationalism. This is a global problem that we are facing. I had said earlier that we have to reimagine democracy. If you imagine democracy to be the majority wins, that's a serious problem. Because in no country can you allow a majority to dominate, particularly cultural agenda, on minorities. In Palestine and in Israel, in fact, it's a reverse issue. You know, if you add all the Palestinians and if others are able to come back home, the demographic situation in this new Israel-Palestine will be majority Palestinian. So there you're going to now prevent the majority from taking power. You know, democracy is used by the powerful in their interests, effectively.
You mentioned amnesia, and in the context of resistance to occupation, there's no context, there's no history, things just happen, people are violent, and so there's very little understanding, particularly in the United States, which on this issue is heavily propagandized.
We know that there is a right to resist. We know that that's the case. The right to resist makes sense when there's a project behind the resistance. You know, we talked about Kashmir. Right now, it's not clear what is the project of the Kashmiri politics. It's so fragmented, so brutally divided. I mean, the fact that a former Kashmiri political party, in other words, very secure in a kind of Kashmiri nationalism, Mehbooba Mufti's party would go into alliance with the BJP. I mean, that's extraordinary, extraordinary step that in a way legitimated the BJP. Inside Palestine as well, you see, you know, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank led by Fatah, which has surrendered essentially to NGOism, to the power of foreign donors. Where is the resistance agenda? I'm putting Kashmir and Palestine together here to show that, you know, I know that people, on the internet and so on, get very, emotional and talk about self-determination or things like that. You know, it's okay as a slogan. But if you look concretely at the political project on the ground, it's just not there. There is no self-determination project on the ground in Kashmir that will be able to easily succeed. Now, this suffocation of Kashmir by the Indian government might provoke it. The annexation of part of the West Bank might provoke the Palestinian, factions to create a new project. But it's not there now. In a sense, the slogan is ahead of the politics. And I think that's a very dangerous situation for the Palestinians, for the Kashmiris, for the people in Western Sahara. I mean, so many other places where there are unfinished liberation dreams. And these dreams are held back by the lack of a project.
What's your position on boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS movement? You know, several countries, have criminalized membership in the BDS.
Well, I'm on one of the boards of an academic boycott, sort of platform. There are many such platforms. I'm very involved in it. And the reason I'm involved in it is quite simple. About 15 years ago, the prisoners in Israeli prisons, the Palestinian prisoners, political prisoners, sent out a letter saying that they called for unity of Palestinian factions and for discussions toward creating a new Palestinian political project. That was a very important letter. It's called the prisoners' letter. The very next year, civil society organizations in Palestine said that, we are frustrated because there's no a political vehicle for us to both bring solidarity from outside and to engender this internal politics. We need space. Somebody needs to help lift the boot from our neck so we can create what the prisoners have called for. That's actually the genesis of BDS. It's about creating politics inside Palestine so the Palestinians can liberate themselves. For years, people who are pro-Israel said, where is the nonviolent movement? And BDS is the nonviolent movement. It's attempting to put pressure on the state of Israel. So it lifts its foot off the neck of Palestinian politics so the Palestinians can properly organize a political space, create a new project for these times, because the old National Liberation Project has exhausted itself. And that's the agenda for BDS. You know, it has a history. So I totally support it. But the problem, of course, is that the BDS movement is here outside the United States, outside Palestine, and inside Palestine, the situation is so terrible. You know, there's such impatience for action that the attempt to make a project is very hard. I was, at a meeting these young children, really, from a camp. And this was at the time of the knife attacks at the checkpoints and so on. And I was just saying, you know, you young people, you need a strategy. You've got to build a political organization. You know, typical things that a Marxist says, you know, you've got to do these things. You know, it's a recipe. And they said, no, we are so angry. We just want to act. And that's the situation of politics. And that's not a very hopeful, you know, thing. In Kashmir, we saw the same thing. The emergence of Burhan Wani. You know, this kind of charismatic internet leader, big rallies in southern Kashmir when he was killed and so on. This movement was also a kind of nihilistic movement in a way. You know, you put so much pressure on a people. You don't allow for the political development of their, you know, project. Well, obviously you don't allow it because you want to keep them in caged forever. But because there's no space for these movements to develop, essentially what happens is you get frustration, you don't have a project, nothing to unify around, and that creates a kind of nihilism. And I'm afraid that's where we are. You know, that's why I was resisting your statement about, you know, the right to self-determination. Of course people have the right to self-determination. Of course the Palestinians have that. Of course the Kashmir. But what does that mean when on the ground there is no project for self-determination? The project is at the level of nihilism, not because of the people themselves, but because of the very grotesque situation that they find themselves in.
And what about the conflation of criticism of Israel's state policies as being equivalent to being anti-Semitic?
I mean, I understand this argument. It's a very powerful argument. For very many reasons, it's useful to not want to talk about the thing itself and talk about something else. I mean, you can accuse me of being an anti-Semite because you don't want to talk with me about Israel. How am I to prove? Where do I get a certificate to prove I'm not an anti-Semite? I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is facing this in the United Kingdom. You know, accusations of anti-Semitism have come to him because he has a politics which is anti-imperialist.
Corbyn is the British Labour Party leader.
Is the British Labour Party leader, correct. So, I mean, I don't know what to say, really. You know, I know where this comes from. It's a very clever strategy to delegitimize your politics. I don't take it seriously. I take seriously that this is, you know, suffocating people's confidence to speak in favor of Palestine. But I don't think there's a lot of analysis necessary here. It is a very clever move to delegitimize speech. And, you know, it's so clever because it traps you. You know, then you say, look, I'm not anti-Semitic. And, well, then, you know, how am I to prove this? And blah, blah, blah. And you get trapped in another conversation. I'm not
an axe murderer.
Yeah, I'm not interested in that conversation. I want to ask an Israeli citizen, do you want to live in a democracy or an apartheid state? That's a question I want to ask. And it's a question I would like them to answer. I don't need to answer a question about, you know, you're criticizing Israel, you must be an anti-Semite. I find that an obscene statement. You don't know anything about me. You don't know anything about my understanding. I would like you to show me how I'm being anti-Semitic, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is not a serious accusation in that it requires a serious response. It is a weapon to delegitimize criticisms of an apartheid country, to silence dissent.
In an article, you cite Friedrich Engels. History often proceeds by jumps and zigzags. I'd like you to talk about jumps and zigzags in terms of the Arab Spring. December 2010, Mohamed Bouazizi, a street vendor, pours gasoline on himself and commits suicide after being insulted and humiliated by state authorities. Within 3 weeks, an entrenched dictatorship of 22 years, Ben Ali, is overthrown. Extraordinary series of events. And then that led to, of course, the overthrow of Mubarak and uprisings all across the Arab Middle East, but not in the monarchies.
Yes. Saudi Arabia, there were protests, but they were all killed off. History produces, moves in zigzags. First, the point I think that's important to make is history doesn't go in a straight line. There is no, you know, progressive history or negative history. You know, everything gets better. I don't think that's very credible anymore. Nobody believes that. Everything gets worse. I don't think that's credible either. These are cliches. I think history has a very peculiar set of dynamics. Also, it's regionally bound. You know, something happens in the Arab world, may not happen in Southeast Asia, etc. Well, Arab Spring, such an interesting development. Bouazizi is not the first person to commit suicide or the first street vendor to take offense. You have to understand movements based on structural changes and conjunctural events. It was Bouazizi, may have been somebody else. You know, there was a man, a lawyer in New York City. He goes to Central Park, throws gasoline on his body, burns himself, he dies, sends an email to the New York Times saying, I'm using carbon to kill myself in order to raise awareness about the climate. That didn't produce mass protests. On the other hand, a young 16-year-old Swedish schoolgirl sits in front of the Swedish parliament by herself, attracts attention, and that snowballs. You never know what the conjunctural event will be. The fact is, these states in the Arab world, particularly the old national liberation states, had exhausted their agenda. And that's really the issue, is that, you know, you saw them in the 1950s and 60s telling their population, listen, for a host of reasons, let us deal with the politics. You know, if we have multi-party democracy, the imperialists are going to find a way to come back. You know, this was a theory used by Julius Nyerere. It was a theory in Nkrumah's Ghana. This one-party state was a very widely used theory. It's not just in Syria or here or there. It was widely used, argued for around the third world. The argument was imperialists are trying to find a way in. If we have multi-party democracy, the bourgeoisie is going to form a party. Imperialists will back them. And listen, we saw that in Guatemala. We saw that in Chile and so on. It's not a totally hallucinatory worry. It was a real worry. So they said, let us deal with the politics. I'm Abdul Gamal Nasser, and these are my free offices. We will take care of politics. On the other hand, as part of the bargain, we will make sure you have employment. We will make sure you have housing. We will make sure you have your children go to school, etc., etc., etc. That was the bargain. In this neoliberal period, essentially, they broke the bargain. You know, in Egypt, very early, 1971, they start to so-called liberalize the open door on the Egyptian economy. Anwar Sadat plays a major role in opening up the Egyptian economy. So you have now a situation in these states where let us deal with the politics and let us enjoy the fruits of the economy. And you just sort of starve and enjoy, you know, the fact that you have no water to, you know, things like that. That was really the structural condition for the Arab Spring. That exact thing. In Egypt, the uprising happens again, second time, because bread prices grow up. Bread prices go up because there's a climate change catastrophe in Russia, global bread, wheat prices, you know, I mean, it was a snowball effect. Whether it's Bouazizi burning himself in Tunisia or bread prices going up in Egypt, these are conjunctural events. The structural thing is similar in all these countries. In the Gulf Arab monarchies, it's different. Because in the Gulf Arab monarchies, these countries are in one sense, very, very disturbingly toxic. What did they do? They didn't say, let us deal with the politics, we'll take care of you. They said, let us deal with everything. We will take the bulk of the benefit. We don't have a big population. We are going to import indentured workers from South Asia, from Philippines, etc. They have no rights. They have no right to the oil wealth. They will come work at our behest. We'll keep their passports. We'll beat them, we'll do whatever, then we'll send them home. these monarchies were in that sense a lot smarter, but also they had much smaller populations. And they were able to say all the royal family will get taken care of with this disbursement of money, and then we'll create some sort of middle class among the rest of you Saudis or Emiratis. And after that, the working class is all imported. I mean, it's an incredibly hallucinatory, bizarre sort of world. You can't compare Egypt, for instance, to, you know, Kuwait. It's just not comparable. Kuwait is a province of Kerala. If you go to Kuwait, one of the major languages is Malayalam. But the Malayalis in Kerala, in Kuwait, have no rights at all. You know, they have none. It's the royal family that dominates the country. So when we think about the Arab Spring, you've got to understand the exhaustion of this national liberation model. But on the other side, the monarchies, which are living in an anti-democratic, vicious kind of system where there was no space for an Arab Spring. I mean, what was going to happen? The Filipinos of Dubai were going to rise up? I don't think so.
What do you think went wrong with the promise of the Arab Spring? Libya, Syria, all of it?
Well, what went wrong was Saudi Arabia. I mean, just to be completely frank, a couple of things to bear in mind. There is an internal debate inside the elites of the Arab world between those who back the Muslim Brotherhood, like Turkey and Qatar, and then Saudi Arabia, which does not like the Muslim Brotherhood. One of the reasons it doesn't like the Brotherhood is that the Brotherhood essentially is a non-monarchical form of Islamic practice. They don't want a monarch. In that sense, very similar to Iran. Islam without a monarch. And so the Saudis were very unhappy that, you see, they didn't have any kind of even middle-class organizations in these countries. So in Egypt, it's the Muslim Brotherhood that comes to power. In Tunisia, Muslim Brotherhood. In Libya, likely Muslim Brotherhood. You know, in all these countries. In Syria, Muslim Brotherhood was sitting in Turkey waiting to come and take power. Turkey began to declare that this is our revolution. Essentially, the Brotherhood, which the Turkish government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, that's essentially Muslim Brotherhood government. So Turkey and Qatar were very happy with all this. And by the way, I'm not saying that Muslim Brotherhood governments is democracy. You know, we have our problems with that. But certainly, they wanted to create some sort of, you know, democratic process, like in Tunisia. And the Brotherhood lost an election. They had to cede power. So that was a process. History is a process. The Saudis then enter, and Libya was a test case. The Saudis, that's why it can never be settled, because this proxy war is who's backing whom. You know, there is a Turkish Qatari force, there's a Saudi force. They are fighting a kind of brotherhood Saudi civil war in Libya. In Egypt, the Saudis overthrew Morsi and funded Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to become the dictator, essentially. He replaced Mubarak, and now he's there, fully funded by the Saudis. In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood and Saudis fell out, and that became some of the intestine battles inside Syria. They would not tolerate Brotherhood government there. In all these countries, this was the battle. That was one contradiction, Brotherhood versus Saudis. Second contradiction is Iran versus Saudi Arabia. It's a major contradiction. Again, it comes down to the fact that the Iranians are against monarchies. Look, Iran and Saudi Arabia don't have a historical problem. This is not a Shia-Sunni problem. When the dictator was in charge in Iran, in other words, the Shah of Iran, he was great pals with the Saudis. They were pals because they were both kings. At the time, nobody talked about Shia-Sunni divide. You see, what it is it's republicanism versus monarchy. That's the contradiction. Two legs of the contradiction with the Brotherhood here in the Saudis in Iran. It's the same contradiction. The Saudis do not like any neighboring groups to promote Islamic republicanism. It's okay to have an Islamic republic in Indonesia, or it's okay to have it in Pakistan. You know, these are distant areas, in Bangladesh, but it's not tolerable in this area. And the hatred the Saudis have for these forces, it's not about religion. I mean, I don't know why people need to always find religious reasons to understand things.
Well, it's very easy. It's black and white.
Correct. But there's a political thing here. And I mean, if you just make it religion, then suddenly the United States leaves the equation. It becomes some ancient quarrel. But actually, this is also about imperialism. and the role of the United States as the guarantor of control over oil and so on, it's got to be in the picture.
Our own exalted leader has described the Middle East as a very troubled place, which is an accurate description, but then no dots are connected as to, is there any, you know, is there any reason that U.S. foreign policy in the region has made it a troubled place? That discussion doesn't happen, not in the corporate media.
And there's a bipartisan support for this. I mean, it's the Carter Doctrine that has committed the United States government to the permanent defense of the Saudi royal family. I mean, that's extraordinary. Why should the United States government permanently want to defend the Saudi royal family? I mean, you know, wake up, people. I mean, this is Jimmy Carter. Why is this, you know, when is the Carter Doctrine going to be invalidated? You know, the Saudi royal family is the most toxic institution in the Middle East. The source of problems is the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the United States government.
There's much to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for. It bankrolled the jihad in Pakistan and Afghanistan. If you go to Pakistan today, as I've been, you know, you see these giant mosques with signs, you know, dedicated from the people of Saudi Arabia to the people of Pakistan. But you had then the funding of this movement, the radicalization of extremism, and that has spread from South Asia and Northwest Asia into the Arab Middle East as well. And there's very little scrutiny of Saudi Arabia and its international practices. You described it as one of the most toxic states in the world.
You know, Saudi Arabia is destroying Islam. I mean, I'm putting it quite bluntly. Islam was such a diverse and complicated tradition. You know, there were all kinds of Islams, various heterodoxies, beautiful traditions created, cultural traditions, philosophical traditions, you know, thought leaders from all kinds of branches, as it were, you know, streams of Islam. Saudi Arabia has come and tried to hegemonize it. I mean, imagine this. In South Asia, people say Ramadan. Ramadan? I mean, that's Arabic. That's coming from the Saudis. We've always called it Ramzan, because we've had a different history with Islam. You know, Kashmir, which we've talked about a lot, had a very interesting history with Islam, you know, very beautiful tradition and culture. But because also there of this kind of Saudi influence, you start seeing intensive Saudiization of Islam. You know, the parts of Malaysia, people never covered their heads, suddenly having to cover their heads because the mosques are funded by the Saudis, and then the, you know, the clerics say this is how it's got to be. You know, you said Pakistan, and then you said the jihad in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But then what about Syria? You know, long before the upheaval in Syria, the Saudis had been funding mosques all over the great cities of Aleppo, all the way out to Raqqa. In Aleppo, you know, there was an influx of rural people coming in because of heavy problem, drought and so on in northern Syria. A large number of people migrated to Aleppo. Saudis built lots of mosques in their neighborhoods, started charity organizations, and that was the basis of some of these jihadi, pro-Saudi jihadi groups. Some of those clerics became, you know, the sheikhs of various factions, fighting factions. I mean, this is a catastrophe. You know, they have used oil money to push a very, very suffocating cultural agenda. And I'm saying it again, it's had a really difficult, you know, impact on the very wide and beautiful history of Islam.
And the brand of Saudi Islam is called Wahhabism. You're listening to Vijay Prashad on History and Politics, Zigs and Zags, part two of a special two-part program. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Now, there's been some nonviolent movements that have had seen a modicum of success. I'm thinking of Algeria, for example, where a decrepit ruler was ousted. Sudan, most recently. A year ago, the Republic of Armenia, not in the Middle East exactly, but not too far away, peaceful, nonviolent revolution overthrowing an oligarchy.
You know, this actually is worthwhile to bring back Egypt to this discussion. In Sudan, what happened was similar to what happened in Egypt. The Sudanese Professional Association, which was one of the key organizations leading the protests, and the Sudanese Communist Party, which played a very important role in the overthrowing of Omar al-Bashir. In Sudan, the military decided to no longer defend the government. It's the same thing that happened in Egypt. The military decided to no longer defend Mubarak. And it's very interesting. Why did the military in Egypt decide no longer to defend Mubarak? Because Mubarak, in Egypt, there were two tendencies of elites. One is the Egyptian military is a major economic force. Like in Pakistan, they have factories, they make soap, they make, you know, flour, they make all kinds of things. And they were in an internal economic battle with the kind of real estate, you know, privatization crowd that were around the sons of Mubarak. So there was an economic contradiction between the military and the Mubarak, let's say, family. But really, it's between a kind of military-dominated state sector of economy and this privatization neoliberal thing. There's an internal economic fight. Military decided to abandon Mubarak, and then the military takes power, right? Immediately, the military comes into power. Same thing in Sudan. The military is actually in power. I mean, the Sudanese Professional Association, Communist Party, they're very upset because it looks like the revolution, as it was, been stopped. It's been betrayed in a way. They want to go further. In Algeria, the military has not disappeared. I mean, the military basically understood that the temperature has changed and they got rid of a man who is really, you know, should have gone from power a long time ago. But there was no change in the structure of governance. In all these societies, military remains very powerful, in charge, in a sense. There is no civilian, that idea of civilian control of the military, it just doesn't make sense. You have to understand the structure of Algeria, Sudan, and Egypt in a different way. The military is part of the national liberation, you know, structure. And so many of the national liberation leaders take off their uniform and become presidents. This was there in Egypt from the free officers onward. And it was there from Nasser's movement. And it was there in Algeria from the FLN onwards. You know, after Ahmed Ben Bella was removed. Maybe we should be kinder. In a way, in the 1970s, you had a very powerful left-wing figure as the president of Algeria, and that's Boumediene, Houri Boumediene, and he mysteriously was killed or died, a very mysterious death. And after Boumediene, I mean, they are mainly military officers in suits. So there's a very, we need a different analysis of the role of the military and politics in these countries.
The great Pakistani anti-imperialist intellectual Iqbal Ahmed decried what he called the pathology of the post-colonial states, basically echoing what you said, the lionization of the military.
Well, he was a friend of yours. He was a very great thinker, very much in the line of Frantz Fanon. Also in Wretched of the Earth, Chapter 3 is called The Pitfalls of National Consciousness, in which Fanon writes about this, these kind of malignancies inside the National Liberation Project. That book came out in 1961. Fanon died at the age of 36, I believe, very young.
He was from Martinique.
He was from Martinique, but he was an active member of the Front Liberation National in Algeria, FLN. He was part of the editorial collective of their newspaper, played a very important role, wrote, I think, with great feeling about the Algerian struggle. But in this book published in 61, after he had died, although he had been through the manuscript, in this chapter, he, like Iqbal, like many others who came of that generation, who were, you know, Iqbal Ahmed, as you of course know, was not a bystander to these events. He was a participant in these national liberation struggles. He knew them close up. So did Fanon. So they wrote with a level of intimacy. They were not against national liberation. They were writing from intimacy. They wanted it to be better. They wanted it to be more powerful. They understood, for instance, and here I think I'm going to say something about Fanon. They understood the power of liberating the peasantry. So if you look at Fanon's library, he had the author that was most represented in his library was Mao Zedong. And Fanon was very interested in the question of the peasantry. If you read carefully, and here often there is a misunderstanding or misreading of Fanon. Fanon isn't all about the urban, you know, sort of urban poor, the dispossessed, etc. He was very interested in the petty commodity producer in the countryside, agricultural workers. The peasant question looms large in The Wretched of the Earth. Now, why do I say this? Because Iqbal, Franz Fanon, and so many others, they understood, and including Sheikh Abdullah in Naya Kashmir 1946, they understood the importance of liberating the peasantry. The peasantry in these societies was the basis of extraction of wealth. You know, that's what they were. I mean, these were agricultural societies. And if you did not tackle the peasant question, land reform, radical land reform, turning over control over, you know, lines of production in countryside to people who are actually working the soil and so on, if you didn't do that, you're going to end up having a system where the city dominates the countryside. The city is most likely going to be, ex-fighters in the National Liberation Movement becoming bureaucrats in the military and so on. And they're going to have this oppressive condition because beneath them will be unfree peasants who, you know, will not have known that the colonizer has left, because this new independent country feels a lot like the colonized country because the taxation rates are the same, the inability to drive an agenda is the same. So I think this question of the full liberation of people, and in the specific case of national liberation movements, the peasant question, it's a fundamental issue. If you think about the uprising in Tahrir Square, it's interesting in Egypt, this in Cairo, the Arab Spring becomes Cairo. It becomes then Tahrir Square. What was happening in the countryside? Almost nothing. The Mahalla, town north of Cairo, which is a textile town, had massive demonstrations before preceding the demonstrations in Cairo. But it all became about Tahrir Square. In the countryside, there was nothing. I did a lot of reporting in this period from Egypt. And what I found was interesting. The soldiers, the army, the rank and file soldiers, are all basically recruited from the countryside, from Upper Egypt, that is Southern Egypt. All from the countryside. When you look at them, they are smaller than the Cairenes, the people of Cairo. They're shorter. They are darker skinned. They are much slimmer because they have for generations not eaten properly. The gap between the uprising in Cairo and the countryside was incredible. And so what this allows is, if you don't liberate the peasantry are immediately a fodder for the military. Military recruits from there. They have affiliations with the military. Cultures develop in rural villages of being pro-military, and then they have no association with the city. You cannot. I mean, this is a lesson Lenin tried to teach us. It's got to be a worker-peasant alliance. If you don't have the peasantry liberated or part of your movement, you're going to fail. In my opinion, the failure of the Egyptian uprising in 2011 has a lot to do with its restrictive urban character.
There was also, you know, this whole notion of the brown and black sahibs. As you said, they just changed their suits and they went to New York and London and Paris to be educated and come back and then reconstruct the old agenda of domination. Now, let's talk about the Pink Tide, a great movement that was heralded. I remember I was at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre Lula was there, Chavez, Morales, Correa. There was an enormous celebratory atmosphere. A new dawn is breaking. You know, centuries of oppression will be rolled back. But in fact, there was a counterattack. And every one of those leaders now and those countries have receded in terms of not achieving that vision of liberation.
You know, history moves in zigs and zags. There are jumps and then there are retreats and so on. There was a perfect storm, as it were, to use a cliche. On the one side, the United States government was distracted by the Iraq war, you know, the war on terror, Afghanistan 2001, Iraq 2003. The gaze was towards from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean. And there really was a kind of forgetting about what was happening south of the Rio Grande. So what you see in this period, the United States looking elsewhere, commodity prices relatively high, and then the exhaustion of the neoliberal tide plays a big role. The centrists, as it were invalidated. The right wing had not yet consolidated outside the period of dictatorship. I mean, let's take the year 1999, 1998. You know, Lula is coming to ascendancy. The Brazilian right wing was still not yet rehabilitated. The dictatorship ends only in 1985. We're talking just 10 years or so after the dictatorship. They had not been rehabilitated. See, today they are rehabilitated. So there was these factors, commodity prices high and so on. And so you then see Chavez win an election, massive mandate, you know, from Chavez up there to the Kirchners down in Argentina, there is a wave. But the wave takes place at a very crucial conjuncture. And, you know, soon this attack comes against the wave. And the attack is fiercest against Venezuela from the beginning. I mean, attempted coup in 2002, Peter Munk, who is the founder and head of Barrick Gold, a Canadian mining company, you know, now dead. The School of International Studies at the University of Toronto obscenely is named the Monk School after him, a horrible name for a School of International Studies. Mr. Monk writes in the Financial Times that, you know, Chavez is a dictator, authoritarian, needs to be overthrown, democracy, blah, blah, blah. Actually, what Monk was upset about was Chavez was no longer letting mining firms come in and just mine the country and take the wealth out. And Canada has 60% of the world's mining firms. So Barrick Gold plays a big role in this. So they focused attention on Venezuela, attempted coup and so on. There was no success, really. I mean, what's incredible, David, is not the emergence of these left governments or that they collapse. What's amazing is they lasted for a decade without being overthrown. The first actual coup is Honduras 2009, you know, under the Obama and Clinton administration.
Zelaya is overthrown.
Manuel Zelaya is the president. They overthrew him in 2009. In fact, there are two coups, one well-known, which is Honduras, but there's another coup in Japan, which is an important coup to look at. A new government is elected. Hatoyama comes to power. He comes on a mandate to remove the U.S. base in Okinawa. Hillary Clinton makes a trip to Japan and then his government falls. There's internal problems in the Japanese parliament and the government falls and we still, you know, Japanese still host the U.S. base in Okinawa. That's the second coup, but we don't consider it a coup. It's considered the fall of a government. What was the role of Hillary Clinton? It's all very murky. Still, in South America, the defeat of Honduras, it's a great moment of confidence. You see countries like Colombia, you know, then Chile starts to drift out. And then a counter-revolutionary bloc will develop, which has now, in fact, constituted itself as the Lima Group, putatively based in Lima, Peru. Its entire objective is to overthrow the government in Venezuela. One of the key leaders in that group is the Canadian government. The second major meeting of the Lima Group was held in Ottawa. This supposedly liberal government of Mr. Justin Trudeau has been leading the regime change agenda in Venezuela. It's not led by the Americans. Canadians have enormous vested interest in getting mining contracts there, enormous pressure on the government from their mining sector. But they've constituted themselves as the Lima Group. It is a counter-revolutionary faction putting a lot of pressure on the left. Now, interestingly, they haven't been able to overthrow the government in Venezuela. This is very important for the people of the left in, you know, across the continent and the region. probably Evo Morales will win the election in Bolivia, re-election in October, most likely. It is almost guaranteed that in Argentina, the Macri government, you know, they say it's not a crisis in Argentina, it's a Macrisis. But Cristina Kirchner is likely going to return as vice president in Argentina. You know, it's likely in Uruguay, the left will be there. So I'm not one to say that the issue of the pink tide is very settled. It appears that with the election in Mexico and so on, things are much more unstable. If they cannot, which is why I think there's great frustration with the inability to overthrow the government in Venezuela. In the United States, I mean, I heard Trump speak at the United Nations General Assembly, and he was just fulminating about the failures of socialism, get rid of Venezuela government, etc., and not able to do it. I mean, you know, even with the full support of the Colombian government, they're not able to do it. And, you know, it's interesting business because the vice president of Brazil is a former military man. Far right-wing man, but he is opposed to a military intervention in Venezuela because, you know, he comes from the Brazilian military, which has this bizarre, highly patriotic sense of, you know, national sovereignty.
You're talking about Bolsonaro. He was
Bolsonaro's vice president.
Bolsonaro himself is a military man.
Bolsonaro was hardly in the military. He's a clownish career, but this guy was a general. I mean, he's the real thing. But he, from the tradition of this kind of Latin American militaries, is not comfortable allowing Brazilian soil for an invasion of Venezuela. So I'm just saying there are all kinds of contradictions that are in play. And the situation in South America is such, very fluid. If Evo Morales wins the election again, if in Argentina the left returns, Uruguay, let's see what happens in the next period in Colombia, if the FARC go back full-fledged to war. Let's see what happens. You know, it's not clear. But because Venezuela has become like Cuba, in other words, resilient against imperialist assault, it has put confidence in the backbone of millions of activists across South America.
Let's talk about culture and resistance. I take my cue selfishly from a book I did with Edward Said and called Culture and Resistance. And he says, speaking of Palestine, but I think this can be broadened, he says, in the case of a political identity that's being threatened, culture is a way of fighting against extinction and obliteration. Culture is a form of memory against effacement. In that respect, I think it's terribly important, Said said. But there is another dimension of cultural discourse, the power to analyze, to get past cliché and straight out-and-out lies from authority. The questioning of authority, the search for alternatives, these are also part of the arsenal of cultural resistance. Now, you come from a part of the world where poetry is very strong and has a deep tradition of resisting authority and power. Can you talk about the relationship between culture and resistance?
You know, Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar, the great Dalit leader of India, at one point wrote a brilliant passage about confronting lies and the importance of not letting lies go by without confrontation. Yes, of course, there is a great tradition of cultural resistance, which is why in India today there have been so many murders of cultural workers. Begins with my comrade Safdar Hashmi in 1989, brutally killed while doing a play in Shadipur just outside Delhi. You know, cultural workers are a threat, for sure. But I want to reverse what Edward Said said, if you don't mind, as a way to just bring some of this conversation to a close. You know, I understand levels of politics. It's a fairly conventional way. It's fairly easy to have political change. You know, you overthrow a government or you win an election and you change the political character of a country, you know, new government in power. It's not as easy, but not that difficult to change the economic direction. You know, you say, okay, now we don't care about balanced budget amendments. We're going to start, you know, having deficit financing. We're going to start dealing with the austerity deficit. We're going to flush money into childcare schemes and so on. That's an easier way. You know, not as easy as the political change, but you can imagine economic change, right? Social change can also be imagined. It's fairly easy. You say, look, we're going to create through our austerity, you know, anti-austerity budget, we're going to produce creches or daycare centers in every city, every street. And what that's going to mean is that gender relations or family relations will be transformed because you can come for free and leave your child and then you have some hours to do various things. You can either go to work, you can, you know, become active politically or whatever it is. That's a form of social change. Also imaginable. The most rigid layer is culture. It is extraordinarily rigid. I don't want to exaggerate the power of cultural workers. Cultural workers play a role in expanding our imagination, but culture itself is extraordinarily rigid. Let's take the case of Venezuela. Hugo Chavez comes to power. There are so many, you know, referenda and so much democracy. But the political level, things were changed. At the economic level, Chavez said, this oil money, we are going to now disburse it in an anti-austerity manner. Socially, yes, we are going to give the, you know, comunas, these housing projects, legitimize them, let these mainly Afro-Venezuelan women become leaders of these comunas. It changed society. What were the Venezuelans eating? Pasta. Why? Because over 100 years, they used oil revenue to import pasta. To be modern is to eat pasta. A culture of eating pasta develops. I'm just giving you a silly example. This means that Venezuela is food insecure. It has to import its food. It's not sovereign in its food. It has to import food. You can grow grains that produce different kinds of indigenous foods, diet, but people still want to eat pasta. That means that if there's a blockade, you are trapped. Culture is very rigid. Chavez tried everything. You know, he opened, he had used some of the oil wealth to open free, almost free restaurants that served, food that was made with domestic grains. It was almost free. People were not going in huge numbers. They were eating it, of course, because it was almost free. But you still wanted pasta. You still wanted import of this, import of that. Cuba, a revolution closest to my heart. You change the politics easily, you change the economics, you change society, deeply change society. But the Cubans import 98% of their wheat because when you wake up in the morning, like other people of Spanish tradition, you must eat a piece of bread with your coffee. And this means 98% has to be imported. I'm just giving food as an example. Culture is extraordinarily rigid. I don't want to romanticize cultural workers. The job is very hard to stretch the cultural imagination of a people. You know, maybe we should change our diets. Maybe we should change the way we relate to each other. You know, maybe we should say caste is just an obscene thing. We don't want it anymore. But culture comes back and bites you. And we have to, I think, have a very sober and serious understanding of both the great impact of the cultural workers and these rigidities of culture that block our ability to change the world.
Taking risks. I think you took a big risk when you left a tenured track position at Trinity College in Connecticut to join the Transcontinental Institute and the work that you're doing today. Talk about that, taking risks.
I mean, it's not really a risk in a sense, you know.
Well, you had a safe, secure position.
Yeah, that's fine. But, I mean, we're talking about people and lives that they lead and things that give them joy and pleasure. And, I mean, you know, we are all people with itineraries and different possibilities and so on. And, you know, I have two children, two very delightful, loving girls. I always tell them, girls, you can do anything with yourself, honestly, and so can anybody. I mean, it's not a class barrier. But there are two things I think are very important for people on the planet. You know, one is to be a decent person. The other is to be an interesting person. If you're decent and interesting, maybe sensitive is another way to put it, that's sufficient. You know, you want to be a comedian, be a comedian. I should take my own advice. If I want to be out there doing more of what I love, which is journalism, if I want to be out there trying to move a research agenda linked to political movements, well, I should take my own advice, you know. It's no point just giving advice to other people and being superior while I sit, you know, in the comfort of a certain kind of job. So, yes, I mean, you know, maybe it's a midlife crisis, maybe it's me taking my own advice, but more than anything, it was an incredible opportunity. It was an honor to be asked by a series of important people that I value, people in political movements and so on, to work collectively with them, to join a project, a massive collective project, to produce a new kind of research agenda. And, you know, for me, it's like a dream come true. It was not a risk, in fact. It was the opportunity of a lifetime.
You mentioned your two daughters inspiring you. Any other sources of hope that are out there that kind of animate your vision?
Many sources of hope. I mean, my comrades, I'm, you know, a member of a political party. I belong to the CPIM in India. My comrades very much inspire me. I have an aunt who has been a lifelong inspiration for me. A longtime member of the CPIM, Brinda Karat, has been beyond an inspiration. I mean, I shrink in her shadow.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
You were just listening to Vijay Prashad on history and politics, zigs and zags, part two of a special two-part program. I talked with him in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Vijay Prashad is a historian and journalist and director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 34th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Chris Hedges, Tariq Ali, Bill McKibben, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of the complete two-part program, Vijay Prashad on History and Politics, Zigs and Zags, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.